The next talk is by Yona Fremimosa, who is an artist, an engineer, an ex-ballerina, and will take us on a journey through fluid computers, handmade semiconductors, and cosmetic synthesizers, and promised us a lot of funky stuff, lipstick and colors. The talk is called Pirouette Machines, Fluid Components. It's your stage.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. So I grew up in Romania, and I started my career as an artist dancing ballet. And one of the things that I was doing a lot when I was a child was to wear a lot of lipstick. And as I moved to Berlin and I started to work with electronics, so I moved to learn electronics, I realized there is a little connection between the lipstick that I'm wearing and then the materials that I'm soldering with. I looked a little bit at the history of cosmetics, and I started to make a project, an alter ego, if you may say, named Coquetta. One day, passing by on the streets of Berlin, I found this cosmetic box, and I thought, oh, this is fantastic, I will transform it into a filter. It was the time where I was learning electronics, and as I was applying cosmetics on my face, I would keep soldering and discovering how electronic circuitry works. I took my shoes and I transformed them into synthesizers. This is what I call a Barbie rack. It's a Euro rack with a modular system that you can plug and play as you wish. During the pandemic, I was quite a little bit bored, so I decided to make this breast synthesizer where you can spin your nipples to create sounds. I took these cosmetic applicators and I transformed them into voltage sensors so that I could kind of interact with my face and the machines. For instance, a very bizarre thing is the eyelash curler. An eyelash curler is a little bit like a switch, if you may say. You can... Can we put volume a bit louder, please? Much louder. Yes. Much louder. Yeah, now it's good. All right, so then I looked at the rest of the makeup routine, because there's 10 steps. If you look at YouTube videos, there's all this tutorial with women that put, you know, now comes the foundation, now comes this. So let's see how these devices can be applied. I created a sound performance where I would apply one step at a time, and I converted all these instruments for cosmetics in sound instruments. Powder. Each device, I constructed the sound for each device depending on how, what is its functionality is. If you know this, you know, sometimes they put like a pate over the face. This is called the foundation. So you cover your whole face with this. And I thought it should sound really crispy. So I tried to compose a circuitry that would make this sound and interact with my face. But then came the touch, the lipstick. Yes, the lipstick is the key essential element for makeup. It has a really controversial history. And even more so importantly, it has a secret ingredient that comes from really deep down the earth. And that is lead, or galena. Lead is sweet, so lipstick always tastes sweet. But actually, lead was introduced in lipsticks at the very beginning of age. And it is still used in lipsticks today. So I thought, oh, well, this is quite poetic, you know, I spend my days soldering with lead, and then I put lead on my lips, so there is kind of a connection. And also, it's kind of interesting that the elements that are in my lipstick come from uranium, because lead is a stabilized form of uranium. So in a sense, I'm really embedded in this whole field of galena. So lead comes from a crystal called galena, and galena is a sulfide. It's a more complex crystal. The interesting thing about galena is that it's the first mineral that was used as a semiconductor. If you know what semiconductors are, they are these little tiny things that are in our phones, in very small scales, as transistors. Of course, this very ancient semiconductor had a much simpler form. It was only used to demodulate radio signals. So I wondered, could my lipstick become a semiconductor? And this is something that I want to explore this year. Of course, these crystals were used for different radio sets, and because they were so easy to build all these crystal radios, the early crystal radios, people took the technology in their hands. They understood their technology, they understood the hardware of their technology. And so was a whole cult of radio amateurs created at the beginning of early 20th century. And here we have an example of a radio operator named IL, operator IL, code name for young lady operator. So when I designed my lipstick, I wanted to kind of make it sound like all of these things that for me were very important. This is how I played it as a lipstick solo, and now I really want the volume up. I had a lot of fun with it. So, okay, thank you. So it's 1924, and Oleg Loshek invents this machine called the crystodyne. Basically, he takes a red crystal, like the galena crystal that was in my lipstick, but this time the crystal is called the zinc side, and he touches it with a needle in a very, very simple circuit like this one, an LC oscillator, composed of two components, a capacitor and a coil. And he manages to obtain an electronic oscillation for the first time from a semiconductor. Of course, we don't really know about him in the history of electronic music because he was not he didn't patent his invention. He died in St. Petersburg during the famine. But we do know that there was a lot of interest in the 1920s around minerals and different special minerals. Here's a list of radio-sensitive minerals that you can use to create oscillations. Just to remind, this is way before the invention of the transistor. I was interested into this and I wanted to understand how I could build my own transistor. Because when you do electronics, you can build a lot of your components by yourself, like a capacitor, a resistor, you can name it. But not a semiconductor, that's really hard. So I set myself to recreate the circuit that Oleg Loshev made. And this is what I managed to do with, again, a mineral of galena this time, that tries to oscillate, really tries. Then it does oscillate. They almost scream. And I thought it was interesting because they come from the depths of Earth and they make this really insane sound. So this is an installation that if you're in Berlin these weeks, you can visit at Labor 19. It's still there and it's composed of 12 different minerals that each of them makes a specific sound from its chemical composition. So the circuit is very simple. I load them with high voltage, and because of the negative resistance of the stone, I managed to amplify and create an oscillation. So that was all very, very interesting, but I thought, okay, there is no use to just make pretty artworks, so I wanted to teach people how to build their own transistors. And this is how the Sizzling Semiconductor Workshop came to life. Actually, this whole research was kind of started as a workshop. For that, I thought, okay, well, minerals are rare and they're hard to get, so I need to find a different material. And thanks to Niall Steiner, which I really recommend visiting his blog, it's called Spark Bang Buzz, it's amazing, he experiments with galvanized steel, and he's able to achieve a mineral that is almost as potent as this red crystal that was used by Oleg Loshev. To do that, you have to take a piece of galvanized steel and incinerate it really hard, and it's going to form these little spots, these black spots, where there's a special oxide. And if you touch this special oxide with a needle, you can get amplification, exactly like a transistor. So I set myself to do this with lots and lots of people. I've been teaching this workshop all around the world, and we've been building a lot of different instruments, such as this one. So these are instruments built by the participants. And I would introduce them to the history of electronics, the history of mining, and the politics of electronic parts. But also what was really important was that at the end we do something with these things. So this is how the Screaming Minerals Orchestra came alive, where we performed instruments made with our own transistors. Now, a very different project, so just to come to an end, my works are a lot about the past of electronics and the history of electronics, but while I was working a lot with these machines and with these heavy metals and getting poisoned and inspiring all kinds of fumes, I wonder, isn't there another way to build these things, like all these machines that we want to build so much? Why do we desire to build these machines at the first place? And why do we want these computers all the time? So I wanted to go deeper in the history of computing, computing hardware. I'm not interested that much in the software, but I wanted to understand what other alternative forms are there for all of these things. So to go back to our transistors and our minerals, Bell Labs introduces the first transistor. The first transistor in the 50s, first use that it has is to amplify an electronic guitar. A very different invention, but doing the same thing, is Parallel introduced. It's called the fluidistor. It's a fluidic transistor. It works the same way like a transistor, but it doesn't use electricity. And this intrigued me very much, because you will not find this anywhere. It's like a hidden chapter of computer history. And I decided to go deeper and make a research project about this whole field of computer science named fluidics. So this is the fluidic transistor, and it's a remade shape by me. I had to dig it out of the patents, de-archive it, and remake the shape. And we're going to get into it, why it looks like this. What is this? It looks really weird. Well, if you look here on the left, you're going to see a beautiful CMOS chip. It's really rectangular, right? This is how we make our semiconductors, our computer chips, look like this inside. On the right, there is something else. This is a fluidic chip. And you can see that the rectangularity of one domain is kind of really contrasted by this fluidics. So they both do the same thing. They are both logic gates, and they both compute. They just use different materials to do so, and they function very differently. One functions with electricity and is powered by minerals that scream, and the other one functions with fluids. Air or water. So I wanted to understand, where did this whole thing come from? And if you look back into the history, you'll find that the earliest computers that we have actually worked with water. So this is a Persian computer. You can call it a computer if you may. It's a bowl that sinks, and depending on how much it sinks, so it has a hole in the bottom, it has also some gradations, and the time it takes to sink you can quantify. So our first need for a computer is to quantify units. Another very beautiful example is Al-Jazari's inventions. He has a beautiful book about inventions that are become the basis of pneumatics and hydraulics. So in the left there is a clock as well that maps the workings of the sky, and on the right there is a perpetual flute, or what we could call today an oscillator, that works with water. Also, if we go later, we will have the MONIAC, invented by Bill Phillips. MONIAC stands for a computer that will display the complex workings of the British economy. Phillips says money flows and so does water. So why not make a computer that can simulate a complex system through the flow of water? And he sets to do so, and he does it successfully. So there's different tanks, you can load it, the income comes as a stream of water, it will go into different parts and fill and empty and so on. So this is just a very short, brief intro to the history of fluidic computing. There is a lot more to say. But then I stumbled upon this field, fluidics, and I found these shapes, and they are so interesting. They look like clitoris shapes. They're beautiful. And I wanted to understand how they work. And they use basically an effect called the Quanda effect, which is named after Romanian physicist Henry Quanda. And here's, we're going to watch a little video on how this effect works.
Струя примыкает к ней. Это явление получило название эффекта Куанда. С ним мы часто встречаемся в повседневной жизни. Рассмотрим, почему он происходит. Эжекционные расходы с обеих сторон струи равны. При приближении стенки сечение снизу уменьшается, скорость эжекционного расхода растет, а давление падает. Поперечный перепад давления прижимает струю к стенке. Эффект Куанда связан с подсасывающим действием струи. Эффект работает и на затопленной струе. На положение струи не влияет появление дополнительной стенки. Оторвать струю от стенки может сигнал управления. Если его снять, струя не возвращается к первой стенке. Таким образом реализуется свойство памяти.
So this is how you can create a fluidic transistor. Form follows function. These shapes are not there to be beautiful. They're there to guide streams of water or air in high speeds, so like jets that can switch from direction to direction, or that can exponentially move to create analog shapes. So you can both make digital shapes, digital computers, or analog systems. And what were the use for this? Why nobody has ever heard of them? Well, they were a bit of an obscure part of computer science, and they were mostly used for medical things, for respirators. They were also used in alternative communication systems. This is a fluidic amplifier or fluidic transistor that can amplify voice. But the most widely used for them was automation. So you know all the robo arms in the factories. Actually, all these educational videos from USSR are from a system called the Volga Jet System, which was used in as automation. But another very interesting use was for space application, because fluids are not sensitive to radiation. You can send them to space. And they are very resilient, these computers, because they're just made of cavities. There is nothing. There's no power, in a sense. There's just a bunch of cavities that get filled and emptied at certain times. This is, for instance, an adder, a circuit that you could add with, and on the left you see there's an X-ray scan of how it would look inside. and they look so beautiful. So the main, another very big use of them was computing. And there was an actual full computer, full Turing machine called Flodoc, which was developed in the USA in the 1960s. Why did it fail? Well, it's too slow. This is the problem. Because it follows the natural rhythm of fluid flow, this technology couldn't compete with electronics. Electronics went way beyond. All of our machines are electronic today. They're all made of screaming minerals. But we could have had computers that work with air as well as electronics. When I started this project, one of the first things that I did was to look into the history of this and take the fluidistor, which is a memory bit, and make it work. And I made it volumetric out of glass. I worked with a glass blower in Romania. And then I thought, what kind of circuit can I make? How can I make a memory that is fluid? So I looked at old circuits. This is a fluidic shift register. That's a kind of a building block of computing. And I make this piece where it's a very stupid memory. It memorizes one bit of information at a time. It also uses salt water. And it makes a sound each time a bit is memorized. But then I wanted to get deeper into this field, and I wanted to really, really index these shapes because they're so interesting. So this is, for instance, a chart of different logic gates. So logic gates are this like building blocks of computers. And usually you make them from transistors. In this case, they are made as shapes themselves. And I wanted to index them. And when I started, one of the things that struck me was the resemblance between these logic gates and the human anatomy. And as also Arthur Conaway says in this book, which is really beautiful, he's making a comparison of one logic element called the equivalence element and the human throat. So actually some of these logic elements are built after human anatomy. And I thought this was quite interesting. You can see also how the comparison. So I take this shape and I brought it back to life. This meant a lot of tries and a lot of reprints. And the final idea was, how about we make a fluidic kit, something that you can patch and play, something that you can bring to a workshop to teach about computing. This is not a new idea. This was already made. This is how these systems were commercially sold to people. This is the VolgaJet system that also had this kind of chips.
Такие элементы состоят из крышки и клапана.
So you could see that they were comprised of kind of a cavity in a flat plate, and this seems to work even better than volumetry. So I set myself to index and find these shapes in different patents, in different books. I went to the archives at the Technical University in Berlin, and currently I have way more than these. I have around, like, I think 30 shapes. Yes, and they will be all published in a book, thanks to one lady that is in the public here. So I made this fluidic prototype, which was compromised of this kind of panels. Each shape is quite small. Here they are not working perfectly. But what I also wanted to set myself to do was to build an actual computer, or what I believe would be a nice computer. So I started with the clock. The clock is the heart of the computer, and I wanted to make an oscillator work with fluidics. And to make an oscillator work, I took this fluidic transistor, and I feedbacked the inputs and the outputs. So you see in the left, there's a transistor, in the right, there's an oscillator. And this is how it works, and this one actually works, and you can see if you look carefully at the movement in the water jets. It's jumping from one leg to the other, so it's switching, and it's a low oscillator. So this was presented in a new installation at Mindblau Projektraum with Zingur, where I managed to set the whole computer in one big room, and each component is milled in a plexiglass plate. So you can see this is the same oscillator, but now instead of water, it uses air, so it makes a sound. It's like a whistle. It's feedbacking and it whistles. Then when I looked at the process, the bellows of my computer, I wanted to find elements that do computation, but that I also like their functioning. So for instance, this is a pulse shaper from Bowles. I took the exact model and I remade it with the shapes and the geometries that I already knew that work. This is an AND gate, if you know electronics, and yeah, it's a basic logic gate. You can use it to compose more complex circuits. In the left we have, for instance, an adder that you can add up two digital digits. On the right you have a subtraction circuit with two AND gates and a fluidic amplifier. You can build comparators, so you can work with analog systems as well. This is an AND gate with a fluidic amplifier. And thank you. And this is how I tried to map all these different elements and to make a processing unit. Of course, it's much more of a speculative device than an actually functional device, because then there's gravity, water didn't climb as much as I wanted to, I couldn't put all the pressure, so there's also this aesthetical kind of limits, since it's an artwork, but I did manage to make it work, and here's the processing unit part. You can see the pulse shaper is working, there's a delay line, yes, that's a delay. And it did also make sound, so there were two parallel circuits, one was for air and one was for water, and the one for air was comprised of many oscillators. The comparator was not doing a good job here, but anyways, here is a subtraction circuit. Yeah, this exhibition just closed very, like 1-2 weeks ago. And I also wanted to, because to be a computer you have to, you know, process something, but you have to also sense to process. What do you process? So I looked into sensors, and I looked into a particular one which I thought it was funky. Here you have a NOR gate, so one of these other very simple logic gates that functions with the quand effect. Basically the one stream is always pushed to the right in this case, unless there is not a control which pushes it to the left. And if you mix two of these elements, you get this funky structure which can function as a sensor for sensing when there's water, but it can also behave as a bubble machine. So in my case, it didn't really work as the sensor that I planned to, but it worked as a bubble machine. And here you can see it. It's paired with another part of a circuitry, which is a vortex amplifier. So here's on the left the sensor. And this is kind of the first input of the machine. And it's picking up when there is air in this vortex amplifier and then making a sound. Yep, and then I thought, okay, I have all of these elements and now I need to patch them together. And I looked at how people would patch, because of course it's in a way a very modular system. You take the inputs, you connect them to outputs, and this was done very speculative. I came up with an idea of how I wanted to patch them, but it ended up in chaos because there are many, many tubes. And this is how the final system looked like from above. It has also an output device, this very big plate at the end. It's mixing everything together. It's like a summer, you would say. But it's mostly, the piece talks mostly about this technology that tries to be something else, tries to show another form for our hardware, and this is what I thought it was interesting about it. And this is why I'm archiving it and I'm trying to present it to the world, because maybe it can help us understand how we can build machines that are more resilient and are slower, which slower can be better, I think. And yes, I think that's it. I'm done for today. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your talk. We still have 10 minutes left for Q&A. So if you have any questions, just come to the microphones and ask. Do we have a question from the internet? No questions from the internet yet.
Hi, thank you for the talk. Can you remember maybe a name of the space mission? Maybe you read something where this was used, because you said earlier that it was used in space. Do you maybe remember?
It was designed for space. They didn't actually use it, but NASA has a whole book about trying to implement fluidics into space. I think what got implemented was that they used amplifiers a lot for aeronautics, for moving pneumatic stuff like wings, flaps, and things like this. And this is still in use in all airplanes. So a lot of these airplane wings are powered by this. But the exact mission, I don't think they sent a computer, 3D computer. They designed one for this. You can find, I can give you the name, it's in a NASA booklet, the idea for it, but it never actually happened, I think. It was more as an utopic idea of, like, let's build a computer made of air. Yeah.
Then microphone 6.
Thank you for your talks. I was wondering if how are you pushing the fluids into your systems? Are you using some kind of motorized system or gravity physics? I don't know.
Yes, I'm using pumps. But the idea would be at the end to use this kind of gravity pump, so gravity system that you can use by adding different pressures and cavities. And there's a lot of models that exist like this, including this inventor Al-Jazari that I was showing. He has a lot of systems that worked like that. But for now, I was not using this because it was insanely crazy to... also, the pressure needed is very high, actually. This is a big problem. Like, I need to find a way to create a pump, a gravity pump that can deliver as much pressure. But it's in the working. Also for the air system, the same problem. With the air system, I'm designing now a bellow, like in the organs, you know. Because for now I was using compressed air, and I want to make it completely electronic free, to say. So manual powered. But it's in progress.
Then microphone 4.
Hi, thanks for the talk. It was really, really interesting. I've also fell down this fluidics computation music rabbit hole, and I noticed that most instruments are either earth, like hitting and stuff, or vibrations, or air, and there are virtually no water instruments. And I was wondering, did you find the same? If you did, did you find an explanation for that? And if you didn't, do you care to speculate?
Yes, I mean, if water is mercurial, you know, it's a nightmare to work with water. That's why. You have no idea how painful it was to do this. It was absolutely excruciating. It was leaking. Even in the exhibition, I had to go every week to, like, fix another leak. One was... That's why. I think this is the main reason. It's a pain in the ass. But I think, you know, when I did this other work where I wanted to get the sound out of water, I used salt water. So I used the chemical presence of salt in the water. It's hard to to make sound out of water, but you can use it to move air. And this is also what you see in this Al-Jazari perpetual flutes. He's basically powering a system of water that is like moving, and then it's creating pressure in air, and then the air escapes. This was something that was used a lot. So actually, most of the mechanical instruments at the beginning of time were all powered with water. So there is, it's a very big history. If you look, especially in the Arabic world, like all of these instruments, they work with water. The first computers, they all work with water. So yeah, I would say it got out of fashion just because it's so difficult to work with it, but there's a lot of potential. And I'm also interested now to try to find a way to bring water as the main medium of sound produce, sound generation, let's say like this. There's many ways you can do that. And I think it's becoming a big trend also, like, yeah.
The microphone one.
So thank you very much for the inspiration. By the way, in the Alhambra, there is a pump that climbs 6 meters, the water.
Really?
Yes, I think it's from Al-Jazi.
Yes.
Yeah, so if you look at the Alhambra, you'll find 6 meter climbing water without anything. But anyway, I just wanted to ask if you have considered like downgrading this to smaller sizes, and where do you find like the obstacles of all the other physical effects coming into play when you downsize. Any idea on that?
Well, the thing is that basically you can downsize. It's better to have them smaller. The commercial system that were sold were like this. They were small, very small. The smaller, the preciser, and the less power you need to drive it. The reason why I made them big is also because I want to show to people, big, you know, so they can follow it. And with water in small, you can't see it. But the other reason was the limits that I had with manufacturing them, because you need to mill them and you need milling machines that are really precise. And this was for me like just finding the budget and the resources to make it was very difficult. But for instance, today fluidics is being used. So I have a friend who's a physicist and he has a thesis in fluidics. He's the only person I found to do this. And he works with acoustics and he's doing ultrasonic transducers, but very, very, very small, like super tiny. And they're testing concrete for nuclear applications with this. So most of the things that are done with fluidics are small. I made them big just to show it, to show off, you know. But it should be small, and I think that's the best way, actually.
Thank you very much.
And with no more questions left, no questions from the internet, this concludes this talk. Thank you very much, Joanna.
Thank you.